And good morning. You're listening to Focus 580 on a Wednesday morning. My name is Les Schulte. I'm filling in for David Inge this morning. Jason Croft is at the controls. Good morning, Jason. And coming up, just to remind you, coming up during the second hour of Focus at 11 o'clock, a show from the archives, Mirage, Florida, and the Vanishing Water of the Eastern U.S., an interview David did with Cynthia Barnett back in June. So that's coming up during hour number two, but during hour number one, one of our regulars. Good morning to Phil Nixon. Good morning, Phil.
Morning.
Phil is an extension specialist with the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences here at the University of Illinois, and your specialty is ornamental household insects.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have a question you'd like to ask Phil about how to maybe control some of the pests that you might have around your house, give us a call. Our phone numbers are 333-9455. If you're outside of the 217 area code, 800-222-9455. So go ahead, give us a call. Phil would be happy to talk with you. Phil, it's been hot.
Yes.
Really hot. What does that do as far as pests during the summer months? Do we see more of them, less of them?
They particularly like dry weather. Many times the heat comes along with that. So a major mortality factor or a major thing that kills a large percentage of the insects that hatch out every year are fungal diseases. And when we have drier weather and warmer weather, the fungal diseases don't do as well. The fungal diseases like cool, damp conditions. And so generally when we have hot weather and dry conditions, we have more insects that are hatched, but we have more that survive, and so we tend to have more of a problem noticed that way. Even the hot, dry conditions are something that disease-carrying mosquitoes really like. We tend to associate mosquitoes with rainfalls, and the ones that are very numerous, the floodwater mosquitoes, that will tend to just drive us inside from when we are outside in the evening or something of this nature and buzz our ears and really notice the bites, they do do better in higher water conditions and floodwater conditions. But the Norman House mosquito is the main mosquito associated with transmitting West Nile virus and also St. Louis encephalitis. And that particular mosquito prefers to lay its eggs in stagnant, putrid, really smelly water. And actually, a rainfall will reduce their egg laying because they really like it smelly and rank water, and in clogged gutters and bird baths and wading pools and so on that aren't dumped on a weekly basis and cleaned out. So actually, when we have these kind of weather conditions, we are set up for West Nile virus, and we've had a number of situations where West Nile virus is found. Several cases, not only in the Chicago metro area, but also I believe there was one in the Peoria area and so on, as well as being found in mosquitoes, larvae that are sampled, mosquitoes that are sampled, they're finding the virus. So it's out there, and hot, dry weather tends to increase the likelihood of getting those kind of diseases.
Really? It seems like, and maybe it's just my imagination, that several years ago West Nile virus was rampant. We had the West Nile virus report almost every time you turned on any one of our media. But over the last several years, that has sort of subsided. Is that true?
It has subsided, although there's been a couple years in between in which there's been small peaks that have come back up. But none as high as several years ago when we had, I think, 66 deaths in Illinois from it. Part of that is that was the first year, I think, that West Nile virus became widespread in the state. And although I'm not a medical person, there is a factor that essentially the virus was coming in on what would be called a naive people to that disease. Essentially, very few people, residents of Illinois, had ever been in contact with them. With West Nile virus, either themselves or genetically through their ancestry. So you had a huge population that had no genetic resistance, no immunity buildup, no nothing. And so we were kind of ripe for the picking, particularly those individuals that had some other health problems to where this on top of it could cause death. Mm-hmm. And so practically all the deaths were in people that were were older and not in as good a health, or were younger people, they had some immune deficiency problems from organ transplants or other issues. So, you know, there were people that were living a little bit on the edge, so uh-huh. to speak, and just pushed them over, unfortunately. So it's thought that there is some immunity that occurs in humans, and probably most of us get bit by a mosquito carrying West Nile virus and get that bumped up every year. It's kind of like going and getting a flu shot, so to speak. So, but it's carried by a mosquito. So, you know, that does provide some protection, but we still have people that die. And I think, I don't know, we've had any deaths, but we've had several cases, human cases this year, four or five, somewhere in there.
Okay. If you have a question for Phil Nixon this morning about pests and pest control, give us a call. The number to call is 333-9455. If you're outside of the 217 area code, our toll-free number is 800-222-9455. And let's go to the phones and see what people have on their minds this morning. Line number 4 from Charleston. Good morning. You're on the air with Phil Nixon.
Yes, good morning. I have a question. I heard Phil, I think, talk about this a year or so ago. There are a few products out, I believe they're either testing or maybe on the market, that contain like a soybean-based product that are used for like mosquito control, other control, and some of them have some other ingredients in. I wonder what his thoughts were as to what is on the market that has proved to be maybe effective or somewhat effective in controlling, you know, against mosquitoes and other insects.
With mosquito repellents, there are two main products that we look at as being far superior to others, either in repellency and longevity. There are some things that will repel mosquitoes for a short period of time fairly well, but wear off after 30 minutes, 45 minutes. You have to reapply them a lot. Others that may last long but don't do a very good job. The main one that's out there is a chemical. It's abbreviated by the letters DEET, DEET, and is available in things such as cutters and off brands of and the brand off of insect repellents. There is also a material that has a soybean oil base called Bite Blocker, BiteBlocker, and that has been found to be comparable to DEET in effectiveness and longevity, and it's been on the market in this country for probably about 3 or 4 years. It's had an extensive background in Europe of a decade or more, and so we do know it's got a good track record and things of this nature. But the company didn't try to get registered for use in this country until relatively recently. There has also been some work with some soybean oil films to be put onto temporary bodies of water. Essentially, mosquitoes breathe by having a little siphon tube which goes up from their body and breaks the water surface, and they hang from that water surface, essentially, and breathe through a tube. Anything that tends to change the surface tension of water, making it slicker, will cause the mosquitoes' larvae to be unable to breathe, and then, of course, they drown. So all their aquatic insects, they breathe atmospheric air. And as larvae. And so there's been a lot of work, and there are some registered materials that have been shown to be effective that way. I don't have the brand names off the top of my head, but they're essentially form a film on the surface that suffocates the larvae or reduces the surface tension to where the larvae can't support themselves on the surface. And these are effective materials as well.
I've also seen a product repels lemon eucalyptus. And I was wondering, it says organic repellent that might fend off mosquitoes like about 4 hours. Is that of any value, or are you still back to the basics?
Still back to what I kind of recommended. There has been a lot of work done on some of the materials with particularly lemon and lime type extracts. Limonene is the chemical name, the byproduct that's used associated with that. And that's shown a wide range of effectiveness against a lot of insects. You'll find that available in things to control roaches and other crawling things inside ants, et cetera. And it's pretty effective. It's got a fairly good longevity. The materials that when you start putting it onto your skin or being in enclosed areas, it's got to be well researched, and I'm not familiar with how much research has been done on these. An interesting feature of our legal system associated with pesticides is if material is a synthetic product, it has to be researched and shown effectiveness, or at least that it's not a problem to humans to use. And but if it's a natural product, there are no regulations that way. So, and there are, of course, the most effective poisons known to humans are naturally produced. They are organic. That's botulism. Supposedly a couple of teaspoons of kilowatts population. So just because it's organic or natural doesn't necessarily mean it's safe. And until I see research indicating that some of these things have really been tested and we know that they've got some safety as well as some effectiveness, I tend to avoid recommending them just simply because of lack of data. It's not required. And so anybody can make up anything and sell it with any claims on it that if it's a natural product. And some of these things have carcinogens and other things in them. I think probably on both of those materials they're used heavily enough that it's probably not a major factor, but I'm really not sure on that.
Okay, well, thank you for your information.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks for your call. Our guest this morning is Phil Nixon with the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences here at the University of Illinois. He's an extension specialist. If you have a call, give us or have a question, give us a call at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Let's go to line one and a caller from Urbana. Good morning. You're on the air with Phil Nixon.
Hello.
Hi.
I've noticed a rather heavy buildup of white flies in the garden the last few days. Insecticidal soap still a good bet for that?
Insecticidal soap is what we would primarily recommend. We have a couple different types of white flies that will occur. One essentially you buy on your plants, your bedding plants, your tomatoes, your flowers, these sorts of things. They're greenhouse pests that may be present in a very, very small number. You know, they're limited to what they can use to control these things on in the greenhouse and particularly on an edible crop like a tomato, things of this nature. So these can build up. The other thing that occurs is a very, very common white fly called the banded winged white fly, which if you get a hand lens on it or look at it very close, there'll be some very very light or grayish-type crossbands on the wings, a couple on each wing. And these actually develop on velvet leaf or buttonweed, a common weed that we have around field margins and in other areas in this part of, in Illinois. And they build up to humongously high populations on that plant about this time of year. You hit a velvet leaf around this time of year, and you may have several hundred of these things come fogging off. The adults will fly to other plants and will feed on them, but they are unable in most situations to reproduce on the plant. And so although you get a little bit of adult feeding, you don't have anything which is a major impact on the plant. We get calls around this time of year and throughout the fall of them coming into greenhouses and showing up in gardens and so on. And it can be ones that you do have nymphs that look like little transparent oval things on the underneath sides of particularly the lower leaves of a plant. And that's probably greenhouse or sweet or silverleaf white fly that came from on the plants when they were brought from the greenhouse. But if you don't see any evidence of immatures, an option, they are probably banded wing white flies, and you can probably just ignore them. Their impact is going to be very minimal on the plant. So that's the adults will feed, but you're not going to have generations that are going to cause a lot of damage. But still, if you want to try to control them, insecticidal soap for the homeowner is usually the best option. And normally you're going to need to do that weekly sprays at least 2 to 3 times.
These seem to be in rather large numbers in the garden on the particularly peppers and tomatoes.
Yeah.
And they seem very small.
Yeah, well, white flies are typically only about 1/16 of an inch long, and so they are quite tiny. That's why if you need to identify them, it pretty well takes a hand lens to be able to figure out what you're looking at as far as what white fly it might be if it's banded wing white fly. But you can have very, very high numbers of banded wing white flies, and unless your plants are showing some cupping of the leaves or other damage, you may not need to do anything about those.
There are a lot of velvet leaves in the vicinity. It's the University Gardens on Ray Street.
Okay.
So that might be where they're coming from.
Might be, if you want to get a, like I said, if you want to be a little more scientific about it, you can you can very carefully pluck a leaf and turn it over very slowly and carefully, and many of them will stay on the leaf, and you can get a hand lens close enough that you can see what they are and get a pretty good idea of what you're looking at. And, you know, we've had some situations where people have, growers in greenhouses have had just huge numbers. I mean, they just talk about them fogging up, and they say, well, you know, it's sometimes, you know, I had to go on, I happened to be gone for a while, nobody took care of them, and I came back, and everything was fine. How can that be? I just look closely at them, they're probably banded wing. They came in the vents of your greenhouse, because they will be exceedingly numerous at this time of year. I mean, really, the whole underside of a leaf may be covered with these things. And, you know, in tomatoes and peppers, you both have plants that were all, in all likelihood, grown in the greenhouse, or if you happen to have plants, that even ones that you started yourself and they happen to be in a community garden where there are others around you that were grown that way, there's a good chance that they came, they're greenhouse ones. But the greenhouse whitefly, the greenhouse whitefly itself and the silverleaf whitefly is not hardy in this far north. It will die out in the wintertime. So these plants get reinfested from areas that stay warm in the winter, such as greenhouses. But we do have this native one, which does survive the winters, but it is not a serious pest, even though it looks impressive.
But treating plants that are going to go into the greenhouse later now with a systemic, I suppose, marathon?
You could do that. I tend to recommend that rather than do that, I tend to like to go with the IPM method, which is wait until you have a problem and then treat for it. That's kind of been the way I've lived by. My wife and I grow a variety of things that are warm season, including some bonsai, and I never treat mine before I take them in, and I almost never have to treat them. So it's you can end up using insecticide unnecessarily by blankly treating. If I was going to treat them, I would tend to lean towards the idea of just spraying them with insecticidal soap rather than using some systemic insecticide that's going to go up into the plant, just because it's cheaper, it's easier, and it covers a wider range of plant of pests than the imidacloprid, the marathon, or merit that you're talking about.
Okay. Thanks for your call. Let's go on to line four. We have a call from Robinson. Good morning. You're on the air with Phil Nixon.
Thank you. Phil, the last time you were on the program, you mentioned that you grew at least some rugosa roses.
Uh-huh.
I grow a number of antique roses, among them many rugosas.
Mm-hmm.
And I, this summer, have had a terrible problem with what I would conceive to be an insect, perhaps a wasp, which stings the stem of the bush, and the stem swells, and little larvae apparently develop inside the swelling, and then everything above that point on the rose bush turns brown within a few days and dies.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard of this problem?
I haven't had any calls before this one this summer, but in years past I have seen some of this. It's a gall midge, I think. It may be a gall wasp. I think it's a gall wasp in this case. I'm sitting here trying to think of a specific name on it, and I can't come up with it. But it tends to show up probably more commonly on rugosa roses and also multifloras. And many times what you do is get a thickening of a stem, or sometimes even the stem gets kind of broad looking, it's long rose gall. It came to my mind eventually as I started describing it. It finally came to mind. It'll be kind of a swelling about twice the size to three times the size of a stem.
Yeah.
It's initially green and then will actually turn kind of an interesting red and then kind of brownish typically. And this is caused by a gall wasp. And really, there is no protection against it. All we recommend is that when you see that coming on, that you prune out those branches, those canes, and destroy them to help keep down the population of these gall wasps in your immediate vicinity. There's really no recommendation as far as preventative control or anything of that nature. And you're right, the stem will die out past that. But usually, if you're relatively aggressive, particularly if you can catch them when they're still in the green stage or just starting to turn kind of reddish, you can get them before the adults emerge and kill the larvae that are in the stem by destroying the canes.
Okay, that sounds really hopeless.
Yeah, well, it's a sort of thing that this is usually not a widespread thing. I've never known of it to be more than half a dozen canes on a plant or a dozen canes where you probably have three dozen canes on a plant or something like this or more. So it can be somewhat severe, but it's not something that is usually heavy enough to kill the plant or cause really severe dieback on it, although a third of the canes is quite severe. But typically you're looking at three or four, half a dozen canes on a plant that may have a very large number of them, and so you don't have to go take it all the way down to the ground either. If you've got an infestation on a branch off of it, all you do is clip that branch off.
I snip them off below the swelling and dispose of the
that should be work. Part. Yeah, you'd do a proper pruning. You would go back down to a branching point and prune them off at that point. This result reduces the amount of open stems that you can get leafcutter bees into as well. So. And then destroy those. Don't just leave them lay on the ground because the gall wasp will come out of them on the ground.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Phil.
All right.
You're welcome.
Thanks for your call. If you have a question for Phil Nixon this morning, our numbers are 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. And let's go to line two and a caller from Terre Haute. Good morning. You're on the air with Phil Nixon.
Good morning. Carpenter bees have the capability of stinging?
Very definitely. Yes, they can. They normally are somewhat reluctant to do so. In fact, you can normally, if they're tunneling into some unpainted wood or something of this nature, you can many times, we recommend Carbaryl or 7-Dust around the opening. And you can normally do that in the middle of the daytime without having to wait until the evening when they're less active and you don't have to worry about getting stung. But you can get stung. Every once in a while you get one that gets to be a real pain and acts like it's going to sting you. And they can sting, but they tend to be reluctant. I remember one time I was collecting one time in a wooded area on a path. And just mainly photographing more than collecting, but I had an insect net with me, and I had one carpenter bee that seemed to be intent on buzzing me and being a real pain. I even moved 30 or 40 feet down the path so I get away from any type of a nest she might have or anything of this nature. Still buzzed me and so on, and so I actually caught her in the insect net and preserved her just to preserve myself. But I probably put up, she probably buzzed me about 8 times before I finally decided, okay, I've had enough of this. but they sometimes can be very persistent and kind of nasty attitude about them.
Are they less active this time of the year?
Generally, they are because the females, the mated females, were over winter, and they will establish their nests in wood in the spring of the year. Form a series of they may tunnel up a wood as much as 2 feet. They will form a series of cells that they provision with pollen, and then lay eggs in there, and then they'll put a plug in and do another cell and a series of those in a long distance, and then typically the female will die out. She has provisioned her nest for her children. Those eggs will hatch. The larvae will feed on the pollen, and then towards September or so, they will emerge. The males and females will mate. The males will die off. The females will look for protected areas over winter underneath bark and things like that. So typically at this time of year, you're not going to see a whole lot of carpenter bees around, but as we get into the fall, you'll start seeing a few of them around as they come. They're coming out and mating, and doing a little bit of nectar feeding on flowers, and then we'll tend to look for places to overwinter. So generally we see the most activity with carpenter bees in the spring because the females are very, very busy gathering pollen to provision their nests for their larvae.
So what, like May and June? Or?
May and June is primarily the heaviest times, yes. Uh-huh.
I see. Okay.
And, of course, prevention of that is typically, although they can go into painted or varnished wood surfaces, they normally don't. They will go through stain, but they typically won't go through paint.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Thanks a lot for your call. You're listening to Focus 580. It's 10:31 on a Wednesday morning. My name is Les Schulte. I'm filling in for David Inge this morning. Our guest is Phil Nixon. Phil is an extension specialist with the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences. His specialty is ornamental household insects. So if you have a question about maybe some pests around your house, Phil would be happy to take a crack at how to control them. And the numbers to call are 333-9455. Outside the 217 area code, you can call toll-free 800-222-9455. And let's go to that toll-free line number 4, and a caller from Salem. Good morning. You're on the air with Phil Nixon.
Good morning. Have you talked about Japanese beetles, or is it only household pests?
We talk about ones out in the landscape as well, but we haven't talked about Japanese beetles yet. So go ahead with your question.
I heard that there's a new product called Bayer that is applied in the fall, I believe, for trees and shrubs. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, it's been on the market for probably about 5 or 6 years. It's not terribly new. The common name of a chemical is imidacloprid, and the only brand name that I know of that's available for homeowners is Bayer, spelled the same way as your aspirin. Happens to be the same company.
And how does it work?
Bayer Advanced Garden Tree and Shrub Insect Control. What it's done is it's put down into the soil, and the roots will take it up with the water of the soil and move up through the plant, and it takes up to 2 months for it to fully go through the plant, which means that we recommend application anytime when there are leaves on the plant, but you got to realize there's going to be a two-month delay on that. So we recommend spring application be done by the end of April, since the Japanese beetles typically emerge in central Illinois around the 1st July. Where you are, they would be around the end of the third week of June. Being farther south, they come out a little bit earlier. And so you'd need to have that on by, say, the third week or so of April to have full effect, or to apply it sometime at this time of year when you've got still a couple months of leaves on the trees to pull this material up. You see, the leaves essentially exude water, and that produces a negative pressure, which helps to bring up the water from the soil, and trees without any leaves aren't moving a whole lot of liquid. So you're wanting to have ones that have leaves on them that will do transpiration, it's called, and pull the water up, and it pulls the insecticide up from the soil with it. And essentially, what it does is it's effective against beetles and sucking insects. There was a previous caller that was talking about treating houseplants with the same type of material before they moved them in. It does not work against caterpillars at all, and there are some other things that it's not very effective, but it's pretty broad spectrum. And essentially, it's just inside the plant, and so it restricts itself pretty much to controlling plant-feeding insects, because a natural enemy, a predator, normally isn't going to be chewing on a leaf or something and get the insecticide in the first place.
So you wouldn't recommend that on apples that you're going to eat or anything?
No, there are. You need to read the label very carefully. It is labeled on, I believe, apples. You would need to verify that to be sure. Most fruit trees, most vegetables, most plants that you would eat, it is not labeled on, and there's a good reason. It could get into the part that you're going to consume. An interesting thing about imidacloprid is that it's a fairly large molecule, and in most plants, in many plants, there are little what we call sieved cells within the xylem or water conducting tissues, and these essentially look like a little perforated plate. Hence the name sieve cells. It looks like a sieve, and the holes, interestingly enough, in the somatic part or the stems of the plants, money plants, have holes that are bigger than those that tend to go into the flowers. And so in a number of plants, the holes in the sieve cells going into the flower are small enough that the imidacloprid molecule can't go through those holes, whereas it can for the rest of the plant. And so as a result, it doesn't get in the flower. As a result, it doesn't get in the resulting fruit. And as a result, it's labeled for use.
So it's mostly for trees and shrubs, not like vines.
Ornamental trees and shrubs. It's got a very broad label, but it's primarily for those types of materials. We use the same chemical to control white grubs, and it's sold as Merit insecticide for that. But there, we're not using its systemic properties. We're using its longevity in the soil as an effectiveness that direction.
I have friends in Louisville, Kentucky. They haven't had Japanese beetles yet, and I understand from one of the extension flyers that they are traveling like 10 miles a year or 10 to 15 miles?
Yeah, probably something like that. They will typically, the Japanese beetles will fly typically about every 3 days for 6 weeks, and they can go as much as a mile and a half. So if you do the math, it comes out to about 15 miles a year. Yeah.
And will this be, will they always be with us?
Yes. This is an insect that got into New Jersey in 1916 and accidentally, probably as a grub in soil, some plants that were brought in. It's been moving west ever since. It got into the very eastern part of Illinois in the early 60s and then sat, for some reason we don't quite understand why, for 30 years. And then in the early 90s started to move again until now we have it in every major city in the state of Illinois, and it's filling in the rural areas in between. So, and they're currently fighting this insect in Nebraska and Kansas. It was originally thought that it would not occur farther west than Lincoln, Nebraska, because that's where the 100th meridian, we get into situations where it's normally too dry for the Japanese beetle larvae to survive in the fall of the year. However, by people watering their lawns, they have enabled the beetle to survive well into western Nebraska.
Are they moving south also?
I'm not sure how they're moving as far as south goes. I know they're limited into not getting into Canada much due to probably cold soils in the wintertime. I'm not really sure how far south they'll be able to survive. In its native habitat, the Japanese beetle is very common, and its relatives, close relatives, in the Korean Peninsula and the islands of Japan. Islands of Japan are considerably milder climate than we have here due to Pacific winds and Pacific Ocean currents. So I would suspect that they would go farther south, but I know they go as far south as Illinois goes, and when it gets past that, I'm not paid to worry about it. I just haven't really noticed it.
I see. And do you know its natural predator in Japan?
There are a series, and there's a couple parasitic wasps and a parasitic fly that have been introduced into the northeastern U.S., and they initially, from the Orient, they initially showed some good control measures. We got about 30% control for the first few years. Now that has dropped off to about 3-6% control. So we don't know exactly why that is, but we really don't have any natural enemies that appear to be on the horizon. There has been a Bacillus thuringiensis, a bacterial material. We use Bacillus thuringiensis kirstaki to control caterpillars, Bacillus thuringiensis israeliensis to control mosquito larvae effectively in this country. There has been a variety called Bacillus thuringiensis buibui, B-U-I-B-U-I. I'm going to buibui you. And it's shown very good effectiveness against Japanese beetles as well as a variety of other white grubs. And about 10, 12 years ago, some companies were very much being aggressive in going to market with this product, and it kind of dwindled out to nothing about 8 years ago. I just saw some emails about it on a listserv I'm on. Apparently there is still one company in the U.S. that owns rights to it, but they don't seem to be aggressively bringing this to market. To me, it would be a tremendous help. We get 90-95% kill in research tests on Japanese beetle grubs as well as a variety of other grubs
applied to the soil.
It would probably be something that would have to be applied on an annual basis.
And everyone.
But it would be something that would be an organic option. But apparently the economics are not there, would be my guess, because certainly it seems to be easily manufactured, easily applied, provides good control. But in a capitalistic society, money is the bottom line, and if it doesn't, they don't see a profit, they don't go bring it to market.
Yeah, I agree. So. And they're affecting the agricultural soybeans and everything.
Yes. Yeah, usually the effect on the agricultural crops is relatively minimal. It feeds on the green silks, the pollinating silks of a corn. Many of our corn varieties we have now are pollinated already before the Japanese beetle comes out, and thus the silks are already brown, and they can feed all they want on those. The plant is already pollinated. It has very minimal effect there. It is a defoliator of soybeans, but normally only in the end rows, because the larvae need to have grassy areas to develop, and so in a 40-acre field, it's normally only going to go in 10 or 12 rows and finds all the beans at once. So if there's treatment needed, it's normally just on the end rows or of a few rows coming in on the plant. We recommend good scouting of the fields to be sure of that. It is an impact, but it's not a huge impact compared to what it is in growing turf and having trees in your better, nice looking in your yard. Yeah,
I have seen one insect that has eating a Japanese beetle, and that was the assassin bug.
Yeah, there are a variety of general predators. Assassin bugs will feed on them. There are other insects, and particularly a lot of insect feeding birds, the larger ones such as starlings, brown-headed cowbird. Bronze grackles or purple grackles, cuckoos, these sorts of things will feed on these insects when they first come out as adults. At that time, they apparently got a lot more on the inside, but after a few days, a lot of these beetles tend to be primarily roughage and very little food value. So most of the birds tend to avoid them. Some of our predatory mammals will feed on them too, things such as white-footed mice and deer mice when they first come out, but they don't seem to have much interest in them once they've been out for a couple weeks. I think they essentially become mostly dry on the inside and very little food value there.
Well, right. Thank you for your information. Sure. You sound like the right man to ask.
Okay. All right. Thanks for the call.
Thank you. Bye.
It's 10:42, and if you have a call question for Phil Nixon, give us a call at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Let's go to line one and a caller from Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air with Phil Nixon.
Thank you. I have a hornet's nest attached to an outside light on the house.
Mm-hmm.
Wondering the best way to remove this.
Well, probably the absolute best way is try to live with it because it will die out in the wintertime. And the wasps that are in there, a bald-faced hornet nest is normally football size and shape, and it's made of paper that the wasps have produced themselves by scraping the outside surface of wood surfaces. There is a hole in the bottom end of that, and that nest, they normally, the wasps are black with a cream-colored face and tail of a bald-faced hornet, and they will normally not see you as a threat unless you're within 3 feet of the nest or you heave a rock into it. So many times one can coexist with these, and there's no evidence that you're more apt to have a nest back the next year if you leave it to survive. The overwintering females appear to disperse far and wide when they leave the nest. To eliminate the nest, you would wear protective clothing to guard against stings and go out in the evening while it's still light enough to see what you're doing without a flashlight. If you disturb a bee or wasp, they will go directly towards light. You don't want to be holding that in your hand. They found you. This insect has an interesting feature also, unlike most bees and wasps, in that they will post sentries overnight on the outside of a nest, usually up to a dozen of them. There will be fully awake workers sitting on the outside. These are replaced every half hour through the night. So not only do you have wasps sitting on the outside, they are fully awake. And what you have to do when you go to attack one of these is use an aerosol wasp and hornet spray. Usually may take a couple cans. You spray through the hole in the bottom of the nest, and you have to ignore, the 8 to 12 wasps that are on the outside that are doing all they can to kill you. So you have to have protective clothing. If you spray the ones on the outside, you wake up the 400 on the inside. Then you really have problems. So generally, now I think you can understand why my recommendation primarily is try to live with this wasp because
yes, I do.
It's not an easy thing to get rid of. If you want to hire somebody to do it, most pest control companies will not handle bees and wasps. You need to look in the yellow pages or on the internet and find one that specifically states that it will work with bees and wasps because most will not. It's just not worth their trouble.
Thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
Okay, thanks a lot for your call. It's 10:45. We have about 12 minutes or so left. If you have a question for Phil Nixon this morning, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 are our phone numbers. Let's go to line two and a call from Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air with Phil Nixon.
Good morning. My question is about ants. I believe that last time they talked about ants, I said, oh, well, I never have had it. But a week after they talked about them, I had a flood in my bedroom, of all places and got that under the control, but I do remember them saying that it's that another time of the summer we should be careful again. So let me ask you, when can we expect our next ant invasion?
Well, in general, ants tend to be most of a problem in the spring of the year, and the reason for that is that ants, as well as other insects, are active primarily at temperatures above 50 degrees Fahrenheit. They're cold-blooded creatures, and you have to get up to 50 degrees for enzyme systems inside to start working well. So that's the reasoning behind it. That's the physiology behind it. And many times you'll have a nest that's in the soil next to the house, and the heat from your heating your house, you lose some through the foundation of your house, and it will warm the soil next to the basement or the slab or in the crawl space. And it will warm up as the temperatures start to warm in the spring of the year. It will warm up to above 50 degrees Fahrenheit in that area, but the ambient temperature outside is still staying below that. And so they will follow the heat. They'll find a crack as a result of the heat and coming through that crack, and they will come into the house. And so by far, most people have ant problems in the spring, typically April, early May, that sort of thing, maybe late March. And then as the temperature warms up into latter part of May into June, to where the temperature outside is above 50 reliably, they will forage outside. And they commonly, I tell people that on a spring ant situation, you can use this or that, or you can do a pirouette and say your ABCs backwards, and probably by the early part of June, your ants will be gone. And that's because they're just more food outside. So regardless of what you do, they tend to go out and forage outside. Showing up in the middle of the summer may be indicative that they may be attractive to the cooler temperatures now inside, or they may just have increased and are foraging widely. In general, we don't look at them showing up later in the summer. We may get winged individuals coming out later in the summer. That's common. But they will have a pinched-in waist, typical of ants, which is how you can tell them readily from termites. We recommend generally for control of ants that we use hydromethanone baits, and these are most commonly found in combat ant bait, and that's available in most hardware stores and even many grocery stores. And that put out will many times control the ants. If it doesn't seem to work after a week or so, try a sweet bait. This is a protein bait that helps them if they're raising their young. They will be attracted to this, which they usually do in the warm times of the year. If they don't seem to gum to it, try putting on a sweet bait such as taro ant bait or Grant's ant bait. Those are both sweet baits, and that's adult food, and you will help control the adults that way. If they're not raising a lot of larvae in the nest, that's going to be more effective. So, but generally, I recommend the combat ant bait because what you're trying to do is get them to carry it back, feed it to their larvae, kill off that part, and so you're killing the next generation. You kill the nest much more effectively that way.
Well, what we had were four anthills running along the side of the house, and we got a spray company to come in and spray. Now, does that mean that anthill could be again active next summer?
It could be. It depends on whether they killed off the ant nest. Usually the most common ants coming into the house are the pavin ants, Tetramorium caspidum. And this particular ant, which is usually about an eighth of an inch long and reddish brown in color, is so ubiquitous outside that you can expect to have more pavin ant hills. Whatever you do one year, you will have them the next year somewhere in your yard. Many of the ones that are next to your house, you won't get the ants coming in. I've been in a place where I live since 1988. Every summer, several times, we have pavement ants come out and mass on the pavement, hence their name, on the sidewalk, hence their name, pavement ants. We've never had them in the house. A lot of it just depends on situations, and just because you have ants one year doesn't necessarily mean you will have them the next. So we don't recommend prevention on ants or other insects like this. We recommend it if you get the problem and you can treat them directly.
Okay.
Okay. I'd like to ask one other question about spiders.
Uh-huh.
Is anybody else waiting online?
Yeah, I have a couple of callers, so if you could go ahead and ask your question, and we'll let Phil answer real
quick. When they build a nest to care for their young,
mm-hmm.
Do they themselves then hide in that nest and die, and the young will feed on the... do they need anything for the young to feed on when they come out?
Spiders are always all predaceous. They feed on... There is very little in the way of... There is, to my knowledge, there's very little parental care by spiders from the standpoint of providing food for their young. Typically, there will be a span of a few days after the eggs hatch in which the female will not feed on anything, so she doesn't eat her young. But if the spiderlings are stupid enough to or to stay around, so to speak, more than about 4 days, she will start eating them. And they disperse to find their own food. She will build a spiders build several different has been several different kinds of silk, typically seven different kinds. They use these in various combinations to do a variety of things. Some spiders will make a mass of silk where they will lay their eggs, and they will also spin separate types of silk many times for their own place to hide. So it's not uncommon to find spiders that may be in a mass of silk which looks relatively similar to us to that that would have eggs in it.
Okay.
But they're not the same set of silk.
Thank you so much, and bless you for all your knowledge.
Okay, bye.
Thanks a lot. Let's go to line one. We have a caller from Rantoul. Good morning. You're on the air with Phil Nixon.
Good morning. I have a problem with carpenter bees. They're very solitary insects.
Mm-hmm.
They like to burrow in the 2x4s that are underneath my carport.
Okay.
I put nails in the holes. I spray the holes. They are just persistent.
Well, the hole may go up a couple feet into the wood, and so what you need to do is have them carry the insecticide in for you. Do this by putting Carbaryl, which is sold as 7. Use a dust formulation, 7 dust. You apply a very small amount of that around the hole, and as the female goes in and out, she'll pick up this dry dust on the hair of her body, and then later she will groom herself with her mouth parts and ingest the dust, and that will kill her. Bees are solitary bees. There may be several together in an area, but each one has their own colony. Usually, they are reluctant to attack wood that has a painted or varnished surface. So I suspect that the wood never got painted. If you paint the wood, you're less likely to have a problem next year.
No, I coated it with waterproofing, and they just went right through it.
Well, that can happen sometimes, but the 7 dust will be something that will help once you when you see them coming and going. You shouldn't see a whole lot of activity at this time of year.
No, I don't.
Yeah, it's
Thank
usually
you.
In the spring. Uh-huh.
Okay, thanks a lot for your call. We have about 3 or 4 minutes left, and let's go to a caller in Chicago. Good morning. You're on the air with Phil Nixon.
Hi. You were talking about a something you add to it for houseplants. It takes 2 months, made by Bayer. I didn't catch the name.
It was made for outdoor plants, and, yeah, I went through it fairly quick. It's a imidacloprid, which you'll find sold as Bayer Advanced Garden Tree and Shrub Insect Control.
And it will work on the houseplant.
It's only labeled for outdoor plants. There is a formulation which is sold as Marathon, same as the race, spelled the same way, or Merit. That you can buy primarily, the only place I've seen it available is over the internet or in especially catalogs, and this can be purchased for use indoors on plants. It has the same basic ingredient, imidacloprid, in it, but it's formulated such that you're not going to have anything nasty come out that's with it that in indoor spaces. So the material that's the tree and shrub insect control should only be used on outdoor plants. For house plants, get the Marathon. It comes as a granule. It comes in a 5-pound container, typically for $120. So it's not terribly cheap. But when you look, if you're really into house plants, it comes out to just a small amount per plant because it's you just use a half a teaspoon or so of granules per potted plant or something of that nature. It's got a label on it that tells you what the rate would be. And it will be effective against pretty much any sucking insect as well as beetles, but mainly inside on plants. We're looking at aphids and mealybugs and whiteflies, and it does a tremendous job on those.
But the quantity you have to buy is kind of prohibitive.
Well, sometimes people that are normally into it enough to even start looking at this sort of product are going to be in some sort of a club or have some friends then kind of go together. And as long as you you can repackage for your own use as long as you transfer all the label information to the new package so the person knows what they're working with.
Thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
Thanks a lot. We just have just a couple of minutes left, so I want to follow up on the ant question because
okay.
I had a friend of mine last night when I told him that I was going to be talking.
I'll give
talking
recommendations on ants, but not uncles.
Okay. Yeah. Talk with you today. He says, are there any pet-safe pesticides that one can use as far as
Well, generally, ants? What we're looking at is that the products that are on the market today have all gone through a large amount of testing, and most of this is done on mammals of various types, primarily mice and rats and rabbits, things of this nature. But one that they tend to work on and test with are, because there's been some problems in the past, have been dogs and, to a certain extent, cats. These pesticides have generally been tested against pets to see what the toxicity would be or pet species. Many of them have been. The other thing is that if a material is applied as an aerosol or as a liquid and is allowed to dry, once that has dried, then the surface should be safe for pets to be around, as long as it's not something that they can easily pick up. And usually once it dries, it doesn't even come up by being licked on. Mm-hmm. But dry powdered material pesticides you need to be careful of, particularly boric acid, which is many times sold to control roaches or ants indoors. That one has a track record of having killed pets in quite often. So because it's a dry material, can easily be picked up and apparently isn't distasteful. Mm-hmm. So, but generally, most pesticides, if they're allowed to dry, are fine with pets around.
Okay. Phil, thanks very much. Our guest mm-hmm. this morning has been Phil Nixon with the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences.